listening to IRIS, the Iowa Radio Reading Information Service. Welcome to the reading of the Dubuque Telegraph Herald for August 23rd, 2021. Support for this reading comes from the DuPaco R.W. Heffer Foundation. I'm Marge.
And Helen.
And here is our first story.
We are reading from Sunday's Telegraph Herald for August 22nd. Climate friendly. City of Dubuque aims to remain on forefront of sustainability and emission reduction drive. The City of Dubuque officials adopted their first climate adoption plan in 2013, laying out a simple but challenging goal: reduce the city's emission levels 50% by 2030 from what they were in 2003. The move largely was unprecedented in Iowa, and the city quickly identified itself as a state leader in emissions reduction as sustainability efforts. 8 years later, it is believed that the city has made significant progress towards the goal. The city's most recent emissions inventory, conducted in 2018, showed a reduction of 27.3% since 2003. While the plan has paved the way for numerous emission reduction efforts, emission reduction efforts' significant work remains to meet the 2030 goal, and while some officials and activists still feel Dubuque is a leader in Iowa for its efforts, others argue that the city has not done enough to be considered as such. However, both supporters and critics of the city's emissions reduction efforts agree on one thing: reduction efforts won't end by 2030. That short answer is that cities should be setting more and more ambitious goals based on the current science, said Brian Campbell, executive director of the Iowa Council, Environmental Council. There hasn't been a level of seriousness for decades, and now we don't really have a choice. The city of Dubuque already is feeling impacts of climate change. Severe weather events in the area have increased by 7% over the past 20 years, according to National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration. From 1983 to 2018, Dubuque's average annual temperature climbed by 1.7 degrees, while annual precipitation increased by 17%. A climate assessment conducted by the city estimates that by 2100, the city's climate will mimic what is currently experienced in Bryan, Texas, with a temperature topping 95 degrees on 48 days per year. Gina Bell, Sustainable Community Coordinator for Dubuque, said the long-term impact of climate change on Dubuque and its most vulnerable residents is the main reason why the city took an early interest in developing climate action plan. Early on, the city made major investments that led to significant carbon emissions reductions. In 2013, the city invested $70 million to upgrade the waste treatment plant to the Dubuque Water and Resource Recovery Center, moves that allow the facility to capture methane and convert it into electricity. A later project transforms excess methane gas generated at the facility into pipeline-quality natural gas. The city has provided financial incentives for the redevelopment of structures in the Millwork District that utilize energy-efficient technology, introducing efficient street lighting and developing streets in the district that promote walking and riding bicycles. In 2017, the city partnered with Alliant Energy for the Dubuque Solar Project, resulting in the construction of a $14 million 6.2-megawatt solar array that produced enough electricity to power 850 homes. From 2003 to 2014, the city's total metric tons of carbon dioxide is equivalent to decrease by 14%, with the drops primarily in residential and industrial use of electricity. The city reduced its total emissions by an additional 13% from 2014 to 2018. Most of this reduction was tied to drops in electricity usage. From 2003 to 2018, the city's metric tons of carbon dioxide equivalent fell from 184,000 to 88,000, while industrial electricity use fell from 354,000 metric tons of carbon dioxide to 135,000. Despite such successes, certain sectors either have remained mostly unchanged or increased. Emissions created by on-road vehicle travel in the city have barely decreased from 169,000 metric tons of carbon dioxide in 2003 to 167 metric tons in 2018. Emissions produced by natural gas usage have increased. Industrial natural gas usage produced 43,000 metric tons of carbon dioxide equivalent in 2003, while in 2018 those emissions increased to 66,000 metric tons. While the emissions produced by natural gas make up a substantial portion of the city's carbon emissions footprint, increased natural gas usage as a substitute to coal also contributed to decreases in electricity emissions nationwide. While the city has had success in reducing emissions created by electricity use, other areas will have to be tackled if it wishes to meet its goal of 50% emissions reduction by 2030. Even if the city were to eliminate 100% of its emissions created by residential, commercial, and industrial use of electricity by then, which has not been proposed, that only would result in 49.5% emissions reduction for the city based on 2003 levels.
Brisk business for cannabis in Joe Davies County. Tax revenue from dispensaries remain private because of the small number of operations so far. Several months after a string of cannabis businesses opened in Joe Davies County, owners report brisk sales, although local governments cannot reveal exactly how much the cities are making in tax revenue from their new tenants. Berry Life, a recreational marijuana dispensary in Galena, opened in March. The business, located at 115 Perry Street, sells cannabis in a variety of forms, including flowers, chews, and vapes. Becky Morgan Savell, general manager of the Galena dispensary, said business has been steady with 400 to 800 transactions per day. The business has hired 7 additional employees since March. As the state continues to distribute new dispensary licenses, Morgan Sabell looks forward to an increased acceptance of the industry. I see it continuing to develop into this wonderful thing where purchasing cannabis is going to be as normal as buying a Pepsi or grabbing a cocktail with friends, she said. Galena City Administrator Mark Moran said the city has collected 3 months of tax revenues from VeriLife, including regular sales tax and an additional 3% excise tax enacted by the City Council. However, state law prohibits the city from disclosing cannabis tax revenue, according to Moran, because Verilife is the only dispensary operating in the city. If the city released the revenue, citizens could calculate Verilife's total sales, violating the company's right to keep its sales private. This has created a real dilemma for not just the Galena, but for other cities in Illinois, Moran said. How do we look? How do we book this revenue? And how do we spend the revenue if we can't disclose that figure? The only person privy to Galena's cannabis figures, is the city's finance director, Cindy Pepple. Moran said several city staff members, including himself, the mayor and the city clerk, are concurrently pursuing confidentiality agreement with the Illinois Department of Revenue, which would give them access to the information. Moran said a municipality can also ask the business in question if it would allow the revenue to be disclosed to the public. An East Dubuque River Bluff collective opened at 673 Cincinnati Avenue. In March, the business sells locally grown and produced items derived from cannabidiol, a compound found in cannabis, such as lotions, tinctures, and bath bombs. Brothers Joe and DJ Lofholz own the business with their sister, Allie Kensemmer. According to DJ Lofholz, sales have been strong with several thousand transactions per month and a growing number of repeat customers. Moran and Herrig have been told that the Illinois Municipal League and the state legislature are currently seeking a solution to the difficulty. In the meantime, city officials are pleased with the other indications of the industry's local impacts, such as a growing workforce and an influx of visitors. I have talked to people from Iowa who are driving over to purchase the cannabis products, Herrig said. It gives people a reason to come to East Dubuque. If they come here for one product, hopefully they will buy other products.
County Conservation Board hears input on former Flexsteel site. The site plan includes safety upgrades to Heritage Trail. Improved safety and accessibility are among the priorities recommended by local officials for 16 acres of wetland property to potentially be donated to Dubuque County Flexsteel Industries. The Dubuque County Conservation Board recently heard recommendations for the property located along Heritage Trail adjacent to the former Flexsteel plant at 32nd and Jackson Streets. While Flexsteel has not yet made the donation official, the Dubuque County Conservation Board in July approved a non-binding letter of intent to accept it. Last month, East Central Intergovernmental Association hosted focus groups and a public input meeting to gather ideas for future use of the site. Laura Carstens, senior planner with ECIA, presented the results of these sessions to the Conservation Board last week. The letter you signed is non-binding, so this is to help you and the Board of Supervisors more information on what the community would like to see and what's realistic. Safety improvements to the trail factored heavily on the site plan, particularly in regard to the Heritage Trail crossing on West 32nd Street, where the county's portion of the trail meets the city's. The two sections do not align, and the plan offers several options to mitigate safety concerns, such as pedestrian crossing signs, enhanced crosswalk stripping, flashing signals or a tunnel similar to the one that crosses under South John Deere Road. Board Secretary Jay Wickham expressed interest in the creation of a tunnel. "I like the tunnel idea," he said. "I know the tunnels can be maintenance issues, but I like the concept of that." To further improve safety, ECIA recommends relocating a chain link fence on the edge of the trail. Carson said the fence should be at least 6 feet from the trail or removed altogether. Brian Preston, executive director of the Butte County Conservation Board, said the fence was a particular concern at the public input session. "There are concerns that the fence limits the sight lines so that when you're going around the corner, you can't see people coming from the other direction," he said. ECIA also recommends acquiring additional parking near the junction of the city and county trail sections, as well as constructing an observation area near the wetland for wildlife viewing. The area could include education signage about topics such as water quality and stormwater management. The property is currently undergoing an assessment for possible contamination, which, if identified, would need to be mitigated before the county would accept the property. Carson said consultant Blackstone Environmental is completing the work and ECIA hopes to have results in September. ECIA will next present its recommendations to the Dubuque County Board of Supervisors and the Friends of the Dubuque County Conservation Board.
A person who makes a difference. Manchester Volunteer helps keep first responder agencies running. After participating in a few triathlons, Julie Woods, throughout her hometown of Manchester, would be a good location for a similar event. "I called the Parks and Recreational Director, Doug Foley, and asked if he ever considered putting one together," Woods said. He said a couple of people had mentioned that, and if asked, I would be on a committee. In 2016, Woods was on the inaugural volunteer committee to put together the Hero Hustle, a Manchester triathlon and duathlon that raises money for Delaware County first responder agencies. She has volunteered with the event ever since. In that time, Woods has watched the Hero Hustle grow from fewer than 100 participants to around 200 signed up for this year's race on Sunday, August 29th. She said she enjoys being part of something that raises money for first responders in the county. When helping put together the first race, Woods and some other volunteers knew first responders and thought they could use donations for training courses and needed equipment. "We take it for granted when we call 911 that someone is going to be there immediately," Woods said. "But if they're not educated or don't have the technology to find my rural address, we don't consider that until something bad happens. It feels good that living in a rural community that we're able to help bridge that deficit." She added that volunteers spend 9 months planning the Hero Hustle with dozens of people helping with traffic flow and athlete safety on the big day. "It's a group effort," she said. "Nobody wants to take credit for doing everything that they do. It wouldn't happen without a good group." Manchester City Clerk Aaron Learn also has helped put together the annual race, which he said has raised more than $27,000 since it began. She praised the work Woods has put into the race. "She's just a very well-organized person," Learn said. "She keeps us on task, and she's willing to get in and do the work. She's just fun to be around and makes the work easier." Woods also volunteers in several other capacities in Manchester. She brings treats to the city's American Legion Post and volunteers at the concession stand at Castle Theater. She said her three sons used to participate in wrestling at West Delaware High School, and her daughter's was a cheerleader for the wrestling team. Woods continues to stay connected to the sport by volunteering to aid any wrestlers who sustain minor injuries during a match. If you want nice things in a small town, you have to make that happen, Woods said. I want to stay connected. I want to know the kids coming up in our community. It's how you stay relevant. I don't want to be an old lady and not know anyone in the community.
News in brief. Dubuque man sentenced to 9 years for accessing child pornography. A Dubuque man who distributed videos of a toddler being sexually abused by her mother on social media was sentenced Saturday to 9 years in federal prison. Douglas John Buttenkofer Jr., 41, received the prison term after pleading guilty in February to accessing child pornography. At the time of the plea, Buttenkofer admitted that between February and March of 2020, he knowingly accessed with intent to view visual depictions of child pornography. He was sentenced to 108 months in prison and fined $100 by the U.S. District Court Judge C.J. Williams in Cedar Rapids. He must also serve a 5-year term of supervised release from after the prison term. There is no parole in the federal system. Buttenkofer is being held in the U.S. Marshals' custody until he can be transported to federal prison. This case was brought as part of Project Safe Childhood, a nationwide initiative launched in May 2006 by the Department of Justice to combat the growing epidemic of child sexual exploitation and abuse, according to a press release from the U.S. Attorney's Office. For more information about Project Safe Childhood, visit www.usdoj.gov/PSC.
County seeking volunteers for four boards commissions. The Dubuque County Board of Supervisors seeks volunteers to fill current and coming vacancies on county boards and commissions. Supervisors in September will consider applications from interested residents. The county boards and commissions with expiring or vacant positions are the Disabilities Councils, Compensation Board, Eminent Domain Compensation Commission, and Investment Policy Committee. Applications are available at https://bit.ly/3rkzutv. They can be filled out online or downloaded and emailed to tanya.lux@dubuquecounty.us or faxed to 563-587-3836 or mailed to Board of Supervisors, 720 Central Avenue, Dubuque, Iowa, 52001.
Our view. MLB's blackouts dim glow of local game success. The recent Major League Baseball game at the Field of Dreams lived up to every bit of its hype. The Chicago White Sox and New York Yankees provided an instant classic. a seesaw game that featured some of the game's biggest stars, 8 home runs, note to casual MLB viewers, that's not a typical total, into the corn, and 2 dramatic ninth-inning rallies capped by a walk-off homer, prompting the White Sox celebration against a backdrop of fireworks. But that wasn't all. A nationally televised game showcased the area's beauty, including shots of a seemingly made-for-TV set, as well as highlighted Dyersville and the region. It was the most-watched MLB regular season game in 16 years. The related Beyond the Game events in Dyersville drew at least 10,000 people, and predictions of travelers from across the U.S. descending on Dubuque County turned into a reality, providing local businesses with a welcomed boost during the pandemic. After the game and festivities, many local residents were beaming with pride over how the area was showcased, and they were filled with appreciation toward MLB for putting the area in the spotlight. But there is a notable blemish in the relationship between MLB and this area that also was discussed amid all the festivities. The league's overzealous blackout rules can make it difficult for local fans to watch a significant chunk of teams. If you're not familiar with the issue, MLB considers Dubuque and much of, if not all, of the TH coverage area to be in the viewing market of a surprising 6 teams: White Sox, Chicago Cubs, St. Louis Cardinals, Milwaukee Brewers, Minnesota Twins, and Kansas City Royals. And that can lead to restrictions on how and when. Excuse me, God bless myself. Restrictions on how and when the games can be seen. Never mind that the state of Iowa doesn't have an MLB team. Never mind that if you wanted to go watch a game in any one of those stadiums, you'd have to drive anywhere from 2.5 hours to 3 hours to get to one in Milwaukee, the closest option, to about 6 hours to get to the one in Kansas City, the farthest of the local teams. Despite these facts, MLB has a system in place that restricts the options for current and would-be fans to watch many games in the tri-state area. The fact is probably best exemplified if you try to sign up for MLB's streaming service. The tagline on the website is, "Stream every game live or on demand." Of course, not far below that are the notes about how you only can stream out-of-market games and how blackouts and other restrictions apply. There is an area to enter a zip code to see which teams are subject to blackout rules depending on where a person lives. In Dubuque, Des Moines, and many other areas in Iowa, it's the 6 teams previously mentioned. MLB has 30 teams total, so that means Dubuquers face blackout restrictions for 20% of the league. And on days like this, coming Tuesday, when all 6 of those teams play but none of them face each other, blackout restrictions impact your ability to watch a total of 12 teams, 40% of the league. For comparison, if you live in the Bronx and New York, both Yankees and Mets are blacked out. But neither the Boston Red Sox nor Baltimore Orioles are, even though those ballparks are about 4 hours away. If you live in LA, you can't watch the Angels or Dodgers, but the 3 other California teams don't fall under the blackout rules. In Chicago, the Cubs and White Sox are subject to blackouts, but no other teams. In major cities like other MLB, less Midwest cities, these three teams have blackout restrictions if you live in Indianapolis, but only one if you're in Omaha, Nebraska, or Wichita, Kansas. During a press conference in Dyersville ahead of the MLB game, Commissioner Rob Manfred said league officials are spending a tremendous amount of time working on the complicated blackout situation. But this is a long-running issue, not something that cropped up recently. For a sport that has had many high-level discussions in recent years about how to increase the game's appeal and attract more and new fans, it would seem an interesting that addressing these blackout rules would be a logical step. Want more fans in Iowa? Let them watch the ball games.
You are listening to the Dubuque Telegraph Herald on IRIS, the Iowa Radio Reading Information Service for the Blind and Printed Handicapped. Your reader is Marge.
And Helen.
If you have any comments on this or any IRIS program, please call 243-6833 or toll free at 877-404-4747. And don't forget, this and many IRIS programs are available from our website at iowaradioreading.org. Now we return to the Telegraph Herald.
Kazert Bakery expanding.
Now we'll start with the obituaries. Patty Gron from Piasta, Iowa. Patty Patricia Jean Dolter Gron passed away on August 17, 2021 at home after a 14-month battle with cancer with her husband Tom and daughter Julia by her side. Visitation will be from 4 to 7 p.m. Friday, August 27, at 2021 at Hoffman's Schneider and Kitchen Funeral Home, 3860 Ashbury Road. We ask that if you are not feeling well or not able to attend, that you visit the www.hskfhcares.com to send a message to Patty's family. The Mass of Christian Burial for Patty will be 10:30 a.m. Saturday, August 28, 2020, at Church of the Resurrection, with Father Phil Gibbs as a celebrant. Burial will be in Mount Carmel Cemetery, Mount Calvary Cemetery in Dubuque. The Mass will be live streamed on Hoffman, Schneider, and Kitchen Funeral Homes Facebook, and will also be available to view later on the website. Patty was born June 15, 1961, in Oak Park, Illinois, to Elizabeth Betty Cuddy and Paul A. Dolter. She was the middle of seven close siblings. She attended elementary school in Dubuque and high school at Savannah High in Illinois, where she forged friendships that not only lasted but grew stronger over the course of her life. Patty was beloved in school, having friends in every grade level, although she was particularly close with her sister Beth and her sisters in the year ahead, and being recognized by her peers on multiple homecoming courts. After high school, Patty studied at Eastern Illinois and University of Iowa, and later went to work in both Chicago and New York City for Condé Nast Publications, where she would continue her career as a trusted consultant even after moving with her family to Virginia. On December 30th, 1988, Patty married the love of her life, whom she daily referred to as her soulmate, Thomas Ron. They embarked on a life of love and dedication to both each other, as well as Tom's two children from his first marriage, Maureen and Kevin, whom she loved as her own from the beginning. In the early years of their marriage, Patty and Tom enjoyed commuting into Manhattan together from New Jersey while talking for hours in the car, drinking coffee, and listening to the Beatles. A true fashion maven, Patty thrived in her fashion-paced publishing office, enjoying corporate functions and nights out with Tom. They loved living close to Tom's family and spent as much time as possible at the family home in Spring Lake on the Jersey Shore. Every other weekend, Patty and Tom drove to Virginia to visit their kids, always prioritizing their presence in Maureen and Kevin's lives. Equally suited for this role, Patty cheered at sports games, shopped for back-to-school clothes, and laughed poolside as Tom and the kids played in the water. In July of 1996, Patty and Tom welcomed their daughter Julia into the world, and a wonderful new chapter began for their family. They relocated to Northern Virginia to ensure that all three of their young children would grow up close together and created beautiful memories at their home in Round Hill, Virginia, where Patty continued to work as a consultant for Condé Nast, all the while caring for Julia and nurturing in her love of classic movies and daring fashion. Patty curated a beautiful and welcoming home for her family, imbued with her impeccable sense of style. A true believer in her family first, Patty never let physical distance keep her from family. She spearheaded family vacations each 4th of July and Christmas in Galena at Eagle Ridge Resort, gathering all her siblings, nieces, and nephews from across the country. On the East Coast, even after the Ron family's home was sold, Patty continued to organize Memorial Day reunions on the Jersey Shore, finding houses for immediate and extended family alike to gather together and make memories at the beach. These traditions became such a part of the family structure that they lasted from the time she was caring for her own children to when she was helping to take care of her grandchildren. Patty and Tom moved to Piasta, Iowa in 2012, taking an early retirement and allowing Julia to finish her last 2 years of high school in Patty's hometown. Living in Iowa brought Patty much joy, as she was now physically close to her siblings, parents, aunts, uncles, and friends. A true social butterfly, Patty was at her best when surrounded by loved ones, sharing stories, playing games, signing together, and always acting as a hostess with the mostess in the life of the party. Patty was a beloved wife, mother, sister, daughter, grandmother, and friend. Her legacy is one of love and laughter. She will be remembered for her effervescent personality, passion for her family, beautiful singing voice, impeccable sense of style, and above all, her deep, steadfast love for her husband, Tom. Patty is survived by her husbands, Tom Ron, Piasta, Iowa, three children, Maureen, Josh Goldman, Burke, Virginia, Kevin, Kathy Ron, Boston, Massachusetts, Julia Ron, St. Andrews, Scotland, and fiancé Edward Griffiths, Kent, England, and two grandchildren, Caleb and Felicity Goldman, Burke, Virginia. Patty is also survived by her six siblings, Jane Geary, Glendale, Arizona, Dr. Kathy Dolter, Asbury, Iowa, Beth Dolter, Iowa City, Iowa, Peter, Suzette Dolter, Crystal Lake, Illinois, Paul S. Dolter, Dubuque, Iowa, and Ellen Terry Sievert, Barrington, Illinois. Patty was preceded in death by her parents, Paul and Betty Dolter, parents-in-law Frank and Dorothy Roan. The family would like to thank Dr. Holm, Nurse Jenny, and the staff at Medical Associates, and of all the caretakers at the Hospice of Dubuque for their excellent care. Please send any donations or flowers to the aforementioned website.
Funeral services. Maureen M. Gooden, visitation 3 to 7 p.m. on Monday. Leonard Funeral Home and Crematory on Rockdale Road, celebration of life, 7 p.m. Monday at the funeral home. Greg Henko, from Buckeye, Arizona, celebration of life, 6 p.m. Friday, August 27th, in Dubuque, at the Dubuque Driving Range. William R. Hottenstein of Dubuque, celebration of life, noon to 4 p.m. Sunday, August 29th, at the Hawkeye Pavilion in Galena, a recreation park. Robert Jurgens, Dubuque, visitation 9 to 11 a.m. Friday, August 27th, at the St. Joseph the Worker Catholic Church, Memorial Mass 11 a.m. at the church. Friday, Doris T. Lake, Dyersville, Iowa, 2 to 7 p.m. today, Kramer Funeral Home. That was Sunday, Dyersville, 8:30 to 9:30 a.m. Monday, August 23rd, St. Francis Xavier Basilica, Dyersville, Mass of Christian Burial, 10 a.m. Monday at the church. Phyllis E. Lipsky, Cuba City, Wisconsin, celebration of life, 2 to 4 p.m. Thursday, August 26th, at the Car Factory Road, Cuba City. Frank B. Potter, Dubuque, visitation 2 to 5 on Sunday, Bear Funeral Home on Main Street. Edna F. Stark, Galena, Illinois, visitation 3 to 5 yesterday at the Furlong Funeral Chapel in Galena. David J. A. Kramer from Dyersville, 81 of Dyersville, passed away Thursday, August 20th, 2021, at home, surrounded by his family after a short visit, but a very courageous battle with cancer. Visitation will be held from 3 to 7 Monday, August 23rd at the Kramer Funeral Home, 750 12th Avenue Southwest in Dyersville. Visitation will continue Tuesday morning, August 24th from 9 to 10 at the Kramer Funeral Home prior to funeral services. A Mass of Christian Burial will be held at 10:30 a.m. Tuesday, August 24th at St. Francis Xavier Basilica in Dyersville. Burial will be held at the St. Francis Xavier Church Cemetery in Dyersville. Reverend Dennis Quint will officiate with Reverend Carl Rieskon celebrating. Day was born on July 14th, 1940 in Dubuque, Iowa, the son of Alphonse Shorty and Irene Lansing Kramer. He married Janice L. Claren on August 8, 1962 at St. Paul Catholic Church in Worthington. He and Jan raised their family and farmed east of Dyersville for many years. After retiring from farming, they moved to Dyersville and they began working for Lumber Specialties, driving semi-loads of lumber all over Iowa. Dave was well known for country music, drummer, in the area, playing for local dances and parties. Dave is survived by his loving wife of 59 years, 2 daughters, 5 grandchildren, and 2 great-grandsons. He is preceded in death by a son, Daryl Kramer, in 2013, his parents and parents-in-law. They wish to thank Dr. Cheryl Morgan, Irig, Nurse Jenny H., and the palliative care team at Mercy One Cancer Center. Online condolences may be left for the family at www.kramerfuneral.com. Elizabeth Tranel of Northfield, Illinois, Sister Betty Elizabeth R. Tranel, SSPS, September 27, 1926 to August 19, 2021. Sister Betty from East Dubuque was a Holy Spirit missionary sister for 74 years and educator for 25 years. She ministered in the Diocese of Jackson, Mississippi, and for 20 years in Sacred Heart Parish, Winnetka, Illinois, and St. Elizabeth Parish, Chicago, Illinois. She was a zealous missionary, ready to learn in order to communicate God's redemptive love. She was preceded in death by her parents and 7 of her siblings. Condolences to her 3 brothers, Richard, Ryder, and Bert, her 2 sisters, Marge and Sister Jean O.P., and her many nieces and nephews. Services were held at Missionary Sisters, Servants of the Holy Spirit, interment at St. Mary Cemetery in Techney, Illinois. Kevin J. Kubley of Edgewood, Iowa. Kevin Kubley, 58, of Edgewood, died Saturday, August 21, 2021. Visitation will be held from 2 to 8 p.m. Thursday, August 26th at Edgewood Bible Church Family Life Center. Services will be held at 10:30 a.m. Friday, August 27th at the church. Interment will be held at a later date at Edgewood Cemetery. Leonard Mueller Funeral Home of Manchester, Iowa is assisting the family.
Louis A. Fisher III. Louis Albert Fisher III, 70, of Dubuque, Iowa, passed away at home in his vegetable garden on August 16, 2021. Visitation will be held from 9:30 to 10:30 Tuesday, August 24th at St. Raphael Cathedral, where a funeral mass will be held at 10:30 a.m. with Monsignor Thomas Toll officiating. Military honors to follow at Mount Olivet Cemetery Chapel by American Legion Post No. 6 and presentation of the 4-5s by the Dubuque Fire Department. Leonard Funeral Home and Crematory, 2595 Rockdale Road, is assisting the family. Louis was born on January 8, 1951, in Dubuque, Iowa, was the son of Louis A. Fisher, Jr. and Elizabeth Lick Fisher. He graduated from Dubuque Senior High School in 1970. Louis served honorably in the United States Navy from 1970 to 1974, stationed aboard the USS Ticonderoga during the Vietnam War. Louis married Teresa Zimmerman on May 5, 1979 at St. John's Catholic Church in Delhi, Iowa. For 29 years, Louis served the Dubuque community as a firefighter for the Dubuque Fire Department. Louis and Teresa made their home and started a family on the corner of Mount Loretta Avenue and Esther Street, where Louis settled into his role as the unofficial mayor of Mount Loretta. Louis was kind and a humble man with the heart of a craftsman. The furniture he built, the garden he tended, the home he curated, and the family he loved all reflect the meticulous care and devotion of his finest days. He will be missed by all most who knew him. Louis is survived by his loving wife of 42 years, Teresa, three children, Louis Carolyn Fisher, 4th of Dubuque, Iowa, Benjamin Fisher of Myrtle Beach, South Carolina, in Juarez, Mexico, and Gretchen Fisher, Tom Corcoran of Dubuque, Iowa. Two grandchildren, Louis A. Fisher, V, and Raphael J. Fisher, siblings, Lynn Bob Miller, John Sess Fisher, and Carolyn Tim Kigler, all of Dubuque, Iowa, and Mark Leslie Fisher of Colorado Springs, Colorado. Sister-in-laws, Kathy Zimmerman of Ryan, Iowa, and Sharon Zimmerman of Hopkinton, Iowa, and numerous nieces and nephews. He was preceded in death by his parents, his in-laws, Donald and Helen Zimmerman, and brother-in-law, Larry Zimmerman. The family expresses their gratitude to the Dubuque Fire and Police Departments for their care and assistance to Louis and his family. In lieu of flowers, memorials for Louis Memorials for Louis A. Fisher III will be distributed among several of his favorite charities and causes. Jolene M. Bastian from Hanover, Illinois. Jolene Marie Bastian, age 60, of Hanover, Illinois, passed away on Wednesday, August 18th, 2021, peacefully at home, surrounded by her family. A celebration of Jolene's life will be held at 10 a.m. on Saturday, August 28th, 2021, at the United Methodist Church in Hanover. Burial will take place in Evergreen Cemetery, Hanover. A visitation will be held from 4 to 7 p.m. Friday, August 27th, 2021, at Miller Funeral Home in East Dubuque, Illinois. In lieu of flowers, a memorial fund has been established in Jolene's memory. Jolene was born on June 22, 1961, in Dubuque, Iowa. The son of Joseph F. and Shirley A. Hines Spahn, she was a graduate of Hempstead High School, class of 1979. Jolene married the love of her life, the late Robert Bob Bastian, on May 11, 1985, in Dubuque, Iowa. Before Bob's passing, they celebrated 33 years of marriage. Jolene had multiple careers, from owner-operator of Jolene's Place in an in-home child care center, hospitality at Eagle Ridge in the Galena Territory, and most recently, Medline Industries. At 50, Jolene's graduated from Loras College with a Bachelor of Arts in Criminal Justice. Jolene was known for her contagious laugh and her giving heart. She never met a stranger and was always willing to help. Jolene and her husband were scout leaders for their children as they grew up, and she even went as far as becoming an EMT. Jolene will be dearly missed by her five children, Casey Bastian, Christopher Brittany Bastian of Davenport, Iowa, Brittany Nicholas, Drake of Dubuque, Iowa, Ryan, Peggy Bastian of Hanover, Illinois, Nicholas Bastian of Hazel Green, Wisconsin, seven grandchildren, Benjamin, Peyton, Adrian, Lucas, Bastian, Nathan and Elijah Drake, Braden and Cooper Bastian, brother Mike, Liz Spahn of Longmont, Colorado, sisters Sheila Spahn of Dubuque, Iowa, Suzanne Burke of Freeport, Illinois, Several nieces, nephews, great nieces, great nephews, and especially her Medline family. Jolene was preceded in death by her husband, Robert Bob Bastian, her parents, Joseph and Shirley Spann, siblings, Warren Spann and Sharon Stratton, both of Dubuque, Iowa, and beloved dog, Brandy. Jolene's family would like to give a special thanks to her friends at Medline for their care and concern. The nurses and staff at Findlay Hospital, Grand River Medical Group, and Hospice of Dubuque. Online condolences may be left for the family at www.millerfhed.com. This brings us to the end of today's reading of the Dubuque Telegraph Herald for August 23rd, 2021. I'm your reader, Marge.
And Helen.
Support for this reading comes from the DuPaco R.W. Heffer Foundation. The Telegraph Herald can be heard each weekday at 2 p.m. All programs heard on IRIS are intended solely for the blind and the print handicapped. If you have any questions or comments on this or any IRIS program, please call our office toll-free at 877-404-4747. And thanks for listening.